turning on the recorder. Again, I'll say our theme is opening unknown time. Because the time that we know turns out to be problematic in a variety of different ways. There is a nice statement by a Tibetan Lama, a 19th century Lama named Lama Mipham, and I've seen this in other places too, but this was specifically in the Buddhist context, and he talks about time, and this is something that, you know, there's not a lot of analysis in Buddhism about time. I mean, there are places where it's talked about, but, you know, we're not looking at that at all. But he says something that is just makes a lot of common sense. He says, how could we possibly understand anything about time? Because if we try to take hold of the past, it's too late. The past is gone. There's nothing to take hold of. And if we try to take hold of the future, there's nothing there because the future hasn't emerged. There is no future. Hasn't come into existence, we could say. We'll talk in a little while about what that might mean. And if we try to take hold of the present, it's too late because the present has already gone. So there's no aspect of time. We need, since I can't hear you, we need a laugh track. We need a canned laugh track because that was supposed to be funny. That's better. There we go. Thanks. That's our starting point in a sense. You know, we say, oh, well, time, everybody knows there's the past, the present, and the future, and they're connected in some way. But when we actually start to look at it, it doesn't really work. So the question that we want to look at that we're exploring is, not only could we come to understand time differently, I think we can do that. I think, you know, this whole discussion in dynamics is so good on that. It's so clear in demonstrating that the problems with our usual understanding and the possibility of arriving at a different understanding. So yes, we can come to understand time differently. The question really that we care about is, can we come to experience time differently? And of course, that doesn't mean that we have to stop, in quotes, experiencing time, the usual form of time, which we'll be talking about in a couple of minutes. But is there something, or let's put it this way, the working assumption here that we're working with is that time is, there's more to it than we usually acknowledge or can usually connect with. And we would like to connect with that more. So the readings are a way of doing that, and the discussions that we have here are a way of doing that. And I hope you will find, I know you will find the readings helpful. I hope you will find the online sessions helpful. I was looking back at what I wrote when we started in the fall, and I want to repeat something that I said there, and that is that although the readings are helpful, the place that this program happens is really in your own experience and your own inquiry, your own investigation of what goes on in your experience, taking time as a focus. So it's an active investigation, an ongoing inquiry. A friend of mine who does something similar that's inspired by TSK likes to say that we should be thinking of life as a laboratory. Or those of you who speak with an English accent, life is a laboratory. That's the kind of idea. If we do that, and if we do it in a kind of consistent way, so that as we go about our lives, we are keeping the question of time, you could say, front and center. Not all the time, but so that you know, every day we find ourselves thinking about it in some way, and we'll be working with some practices that are meant to help with that. Every day as we do that, something should shift. When I say should, I mean I expect that something will shift for us. We will start to recognize possibilities within our experience. that confirm, you could say, the dynamic of time, and, which is the topic of the dynamic of time will be something we're concerned with, we're interested in and are looking at. So this is just an encouragement at the outset. Ask these questions, you know, it's really good to work with the reading and think it through and make sure you understand what's being said. And it's very beautiful and inspiring. So that in itself has its own dynamic, but be looking in your experience, be looking at how time works. And hopefully we'll have some suggestions. I'll have some suggestions, but you will be able to support each other in looking for ways to explore time. And so, again, of course, I encourage you to use the website for that and use the discussions for that. I think we made some changes in the website about a month ago that I think support that, encourage that kind of discussion, make it easier. So I invite you, I encourage you to look at that, to work with the website and be, you know, exchanging ideas and experiences with each other. I'm actually going to give you an assignment in a little while that is meant to encourage you to do that. So, okay, in the last program in the fall, at least in the last chapter, what we were working with for the last several weeks, we were looking at the past. So the basic idea here is this. We say, oh, well, time, you know, there's three aspects to time, and they unfold in a linear way. There's the past, the present, and the future. But when we try to look at that, nothing much happens. We can't get very far with it. You could say, for the reason that I started with Lama Mipham, you know, we can't take hold of past or present and future. There's nothing to engage. So the approach that we're in the middle of right now is to say, well, let's look at each dimension, or at least at the dimensions of the past and the future, separately. Let's make those the focus. And when I say separately, I don't really mean that we'll try to carve out the past or carve out the future. The idea is more, if you put the past at the center, if you say, well, what does it mean to have a past-centered view of time? Where do you get to? And that's what we were doing in the last program. And now we're saying, if you put the future in the center, where does that get you? And it's a really fundamental shift. And in some ways, we're moving into easier territory right now, easier in the sense of being more inviting, because the thing that we discovered about the past was that to go back to that quote, it's too late. You know, the past has already happened. It's dead. People talk about the dead hand of the past, and that means something very specific. But that's roughly the idea, is when we look in terms of the past and we look in terms of identities, so in order to see something that's happened, we give it an identity, or you could say it the other way around. Once we give something an identity, we're already looking at it in terms of a construct that's been assigned in the past. So that focus on the past leaves us with a world that is, in a very fundamental way, lifeless. You know, we all have a sense of being alive, but we operate... A little echo coming from somewhere. Don't have any good thoughts about why. But it's not too bad, so we'll keep going. We operate with a sense of aliveness that is constrained by the fact that we're moving in a world that's already been set up in advance. It's already been identified in terms of structures that are imposed in the past. So we're living in a world, and this is a phrase that we looked at last quarter, in a world that has already happened it. So that adding of that second ed at the end of happened it is meant to suggest that the kind of essence of the world that we usually experience is a past-centeredness, which is not alive. And so that's one reason that Rinpoche says at the very end of the last chapter, the one that we were reading last session, at the top of page 90, he talks about, it's very dramatic, actually. He talks about a silent battle for the being of time. Our usual structure, because this linear structure of past, present, future is very much related to this focus on the past and identity and working with things that had been identified in advance or in the past. So that's where we are. And he says that there's kind of a silent battle. Is that what we understand time to be? Or is time something more dynamic and alive? And that's what he means, I think, when he's talking about a silent battle. He says, at stake in this silent battle for the being of time is whether we are truly alive. And he explains that in the terms that I've been trying to summarize here. He says, the recordings of the past have no vitality to offer us. And then he says, but we don't seem to have any choice. We don't seem to have any alternative. So what can we do? Well, that's what we intend to explore this quarter. And that's what Rinpoche explores starting in this chapter, which starts our reading, the chapter that's called The Future Infinitive. And that term infinitive we won't be talking about this week, but I think we'll get to it a little later as we move through this chapter. So the chapter starts with the idea that we do have experiences which seem more alive. Some experiences seem more alive than others. And in those experiences, we are actually experiencing something about time that is really important and that is potentially our entry point, if we can just figure out how to connect with it. So at the very beginning of the chapter on page 91, Rinpoche is talking about occasions when time's power became almost tangible. So he gives some examples. There was an emergency that we had to deal with, or we had some experience of great joy or great sorrow, or we were suddenly overwhelmed. He says here we have a premonition of our own death, a sense of our own mortality, and of time unfolding toward death. For some people, that becomes a very real, very powerful insight, a realization. And then he gives another example, which is you're really working hard. You have a deadline, and you're working maybe with other people to accomplish this deadline. And there's things come alive. In that situation, in the other kinds of situation. So there's this very interesting connection at the outset between time and aliveness. Some of you may be interested in thinking this through from a kind of philosophical perspective, and this is not something I've thought about a lot, but in the 19th century, there was a big debate about what was called vitalism. Vitalism was the view that said that there's this fundamental dividing line between inanimate matter, just ordinary matter, and living beings, that there is a life force, and that's what vitalism refers to, that just you couldn't really explain in terms of matter. Well, nowadays that view is completely discarded. Nobody's a vitalist anymore, I don't think. But what was being pointed to there, may not have been said in a way that works for us now, but what was being pointed to is that being alive is being connected to time in a particular way, has a kind of timeliness to it. A timing dimension to it that is special, that is unique. And I don't know if anybody has really made that connection. I mean, you know, everybody writes about everything all the time, so probably somebody has explored this relationship between vitalism and different understandings of time. But from our point of view, you know, we're not going to explore it, but somebody might want to look into that, because I think there's some, might be some potential there. But in any event, we certainly talk about time in terms of vitality and aliveness. So I want to give you a homework assignment in that regard, and I hope you choose to do it, and that is to post on the web in the discussion area a description of a time when you felt more alive, you know, a time of vitality, an experience in which you just had, as he says at the bottom of that first paragraph, you had an almost overwhelming sense of aliveness. I don't mean, it doesn't have to be a long description, you know, a paragraph or two is plenty, but something where you describe not only what the situation was, and you don't have to go into detail on that necessarily, but how that felt. You know, can you really say that in an experience like that, you had a different sense of being alive, and was that connected with time? So I'm asking you to look in your own experience and see whether this description at the beginning of the chapter, whether that makes sense. And to share your sense of that, if you do find some parallel, to share that with us on the web. So that's the assignment for the week. And then, of course, everybody can comment if they like, or at least look over what people have written. And I hope that'll help make this a little more alive. It's important to recognize, it seems to me, that we're always looking for that kind of aliveness. And that's exactly what the linear past-centered view of time leaves out. So, you know, people seek out extreme situations, and I think one way to describe that, I mean, not everybody, but some people seek out extreme situations. I mean, you know, extreme sports or danger, or even just going to, even just art of different kinds, or the one that I've never understood myself, but I theoretically I kind of understand it, is going to horror movies or scary movies. You know, why do people like to be scared? That's what I haven't understood. But theoretically, I would say they like to be scared because it makes them feel more alive. You know, their heart is pounding. They know they're there. We know we're alive in a situation like that. And it's kind of a cheap thrill in the sense that, you know, you don't have to be climbing a mountain and facing the possibility that you'll fall off and die. You're just sitting in a seat in the movie theater. But you're engaged and you feel more alive. And I think that feeling more alive is something that people care about. They recognize that that's what's missing, or we recognize that that's missing in a very fundamental way. So we would like to be able to arrive at that kind of experience and be able to draw on it or be able to engage it in every moment. And what that means, of course, is that you don't have to seek out special experiences, right? You know, one way in which people do that, which I can relate to because I've felt that way a little less as I get older, but is when you're traveling in a foreign country, you know, where a place where you don't know your way around. I think, why do people like to do that? Well, I guess there are lots of motives. But I think one thing is that all of the things that you're used to doing, all of the things that are very ordinary, suddenly become more alive. The time that unfolds as you do them is charged in a special way. So, you know, it may be that you take the subway or the metro to work every day at home. And that's just boring and routine, and you don't think about it, and your mind is somewhere else, and it's just kind of the average you know, I don't want to say dead, but it isn't very alive. But then if you go to a foreign country and a foreign city and you take the metro, it's roughly the same experience, but everything seems alive. You know, you're, I mean, number one, you're worried because you don't know if you're taking the right train. You don't know if you're going to get where you're supposed to go. And then the people you see, they kind of look like the people you see at home, but there's something a little different. And it's, you know, everything's a little different, and that difference is enough to create aliveness. And what we can say about that is that in each moment of that experience, something is alive, and that something alive is the dynamic of time. And that's really what we're looking for, I think. That's part, you know, that's not the end point. That's not a complete way to describe what we're interested in. But we would like to be able to touch the dynamic of time. So what Rinpoche says in the second paragraph, in the chapter, he's talking about these times of vitality, and he says they reveal the momentum of time as a thrusting, driving presence. When we awaken to this momentum, experience becomes something different from what it usually is. Right? And then he has this very lovely sentence. It's one of these sentences that I think is so well put. He says, the interaction of identified entities gives way to shifting shapes unfolding in unbroken presentation. So that sentence essentially describes the shift from a past-centered way of being to a future-centered or unknown way of being. I can't say future because that doesn't get introduced till the next paragraph, but I'm cheating a little bit. But, you know, we live in a world of identified entities and the interaction of identified entities, which is a little bit like, you know, moving pieces around in a video game, I guess, or I'm thinking of board games because I don't play video games. But, you know, you kind of move around these things that are already established, that already have their identities, that have already happened it. And so the set of possibilities or possible outcomes is very strongly limited. That's the past. That's the interaction of identified entities. The other possibility is shifting shapes unfolding in unbroken presentation. And that's meant to introduce the possibility of the future. And that's where Rinpoche goes immediately afterwards. He says one way to invite such experience into our lives is to focus on the unshaped possibilities of the future. And again, he makes the distinction between what he calls the temporal order and you know, for those of you who've read around a lot in the TSK books, you could also think about the field communique, which comes up earlier in this book, or about the logos, which gets talked about in Love of Knowledge. There are many places where Rinpoche identifies this pre-existing order, which is what controls or shapes and limits our lives. So there's this shift from a pre-existing temporal order in which we can only interact, and I'm looking now at the top of page 92, we can only interact in ways that confirm the past and thus found the real. And then he makes this really beautiful analysis. I think it's beautiful because it's so straightforward. It's so simple. It's so, you could say, undeniable. At least that's how I see it. He says, you know, if we're focused on the past, we're going to be experiencing things in terms of a pre-existing temporal order. But if we focus on the future, nothing is ever established. Okay, so now we get to see Karin on video. If we focus on the future, nothing is established. As he says here, nothing is founded. Everything is unfounded. The possible persists as possible. It never comes into being. Right? There's no substance. There's nothing that's identified. everything remains indeterminate. I'm just picking and choosing a few words here from this first paragraph at the top of page 92. Nothing is established, possibility and potential prevail. That's where the aliveness can come in. And that's why looking at the future is inherently, you could say, well, I was going to say more fun, but let's say it has more potential than looking at the past. When we look at the past, we just want to figure out what's going on. Why is it that the life has drained out of our experience or tends to drain out of our experience? It's because we give priority to the past. But when we give priority to the present, when we put, rather the future, and we put the future at the center of our experience, aliveness is available because nothing has ever been established. Nothing has happened, right? So it's this huge shift that we're talking about. So I want to make one point that I think is really, really, really important to understand. And that is that when we talk about the future as being unfounded and we say, you know, nothing has ever been established, that's not meant to contradict our usual way of working with time. So our usual way of working with time has to do with this linear structure of past, present, and future. And it's really easy to, you know, one of the nice things about talking about that in this context, you know, and here we are meeting together on the internet, is that this wouldn't work. You know, we couldn't do this unless we had the usual understanding of time, of past and present and future, unless we had a calendar and a clock. You know, it's 9 o'clock my time, 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. So it's time for this meeting. And for each of you, even though, I mean, we begin to see that time is kind of arbitrary because if you're in Germany, it's not 9 o'clock, it's 6 o'clock or 1800, 18, I guess. I don't know how to say that, 18 o'clock. That shows it's a little arbitrary, but in fact, we need that. We need a way of being able to measure time. Because then we can get together, you know, and, you know, of course, computers operate by very precisely measuring time. All of that is indispensable, and there's no need to challenge it. But we also need to understand, and this is going maybe a little farther than I had planned on going, but it just seems to me to make sense to say this. We need to understand that that's not time at all. When we rely on clocks, or when we build machinery that relies on very precise temporal measurements, the most that you can say is that you're measuring time. So, you know, sometimes time is defined as what clocks measure, and that's helpful to think about it that way, because you realize that's such a terrible definition. It doesn't have anything to do with the sense of aliveness that we have in mind, you know, when we say time's overwhelming presence as or overwhelming force or momentum, as Rinpoche puts it at the beginning of this chapter. But there's this other way of talking about time where we say, well, there's seconds and minutes and hours and days and years and so on. That's a way, we say, of measuring time. So the first point is we don't want to confuse that measure of time with time itself. When we say, does a second, you know, tell us anything about time? They're saying there are 60 seconds in a minute. Does that tell us anything about time? The answer is no, it doesn't tell us anything at all about time. It tells us about a measurement that we use for time, but it doesn't tell us anything about time. And the part that goes a little farther than I was going to go is just it strikes me that you could say, well, at least it's measuring time. But it isn't even doing that. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with the aliveness of time. And the fact that we use the word time there is in some ways very confusing. It makes sense, and I'm not saying we should shift away from it. It's a story that makes sense. You know, we will be meeting again 1 week from today. That makes really good sense. I could not, if I thought about it for 100 years, I'm sure I couldn't come up with a better story, a better way of describing the possibility for our connecting again on the internet than to say, yeah, you know, 1 week is going to go by and then we'll be here again. Somehow that is connected to time, but it seems like it's missing what's really fundamental in time. So, you know, one way to think about that is to say, well, that's kind of clock time. Or you could say it's the way of describing time that makes sense when we think in terms of things. Thing in the broadest possible sense, when we think in terms of the physical universe, you know, I mean, obviously, days and the calendar and the clock have to do with the way the Earth moves around the sun. And I guess the way the moon moves around the Earth. So things move in a certain way. So you could say that we measure those movements and then we refine that measurement and we come up with seconds and tenths of seconds and milliseconds and nanoseconds and so on. We get very, very sophisticated. You could say what we're doing is measuring the movement of objects through space. And somehow that's connected with time, but it really isn't time at all. It's measuring the movement of objects through space. That's it. You know, the formal definition of a second now has something to do, I think, with the decay of a cesium atom or something. You know, so it's events that happen. The whole idea of an event is worth questioning. It's something we don't really understand very well. So there is that way of working with time or thinking about time, and we don't need to set it aside or pretend that it doesn't exist. It's just not what's interesting about time. And everybody knows how to do that pretty well. We will all, if we choose to, be here again a week from now for another phone call on the internet. We don't need to study that, you know. That's what they teach us in school. That's what they teach us when we're, 8 years old or something. We get very, very good at it. There's no point in spending a lot of time on that. There's also no point in dismissing it. That's really all I'm wanting to say. But it would be a big mistake to think that that tells us anything useful about time. So I saw a little video clip the other day that it's only an analogy, but I thought it was quite good. It was a philosopher saying, he was talking about consciousness, not time, but the same point applies. He said, thinking that you can understand consciousness by understanding by investigating the brain is like thinking that you can understand the value of money by investigating the paper that it's printed on. And I think time is something like that. We find a way to make use of the movement of objects in space, which is somehow related to time. We find a way to make use of that by measuring out time. And then we get very used to that. And then we start to think, well, seconds are real. Minutes are real. They're not. They're just measures. They are related to time. I'm not saying we shouldn't be using the word, but it's not, at the very least, let's say it's not what we're interested in. I think that's pretty obvious, really. Let me just go on with it for a moment or two longer. And that is, or what I really want to say is, you know, being able to measure out time, for instance, lets us predict things. So you can predict that 1 week from now, exactly 1 week from now, in terms of the way we measure time, we're going to be having another class. I mean, maybe we won't. Maybe something dramatic will happen. But chances are very good that we will be having another class. And during much of that class anyway, I will be talking just the way I'm talking now. And you can predict all of that. But if you think about it, you know, that level of prediction doesn't actually tell us anything about the future, because the future hasn't happened. The future is unfounded. The future is just all possibility. So you can say, okay, Jack's going to be talking in a week, but you don't know what I'll be saying. You can say he's probably going to be talking about the next section of the chapter. Fine. But this moment of experience, I mean, let's look at this one right now. You couldn't have predicted it. You couldn't even have predicted it a minute ago. And, one of my favorite ways of noticing that for myself is just that I can't even predict what I'm going to say next. When I become conscious of that process, then I'm trying to do this right now. I can almost hear the words forming. This is something you might try to do during the week. When you say something, do you know what's going to come out of your mouth next? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you plan things out in advance. So say you're in a class and you're going around the room and everybody's saying something. You may plan out in advance roughly what you're going to say. But that's an unusual situation, and even then it's only a rough planning. Ordinarily, right now, when I'm talking, I don't know what I'm going to be saying a second from now. It's a very strange thing, actually. Where does the, there's a certain sense. Obviously, I'm headed in a certain direction, or I couldn't utter a sentence. You know, I could hardly utter a word but before I utter the end of a word, especially if it's got more than one syllable, so we say the word syllable, let's say, and before I get to the U in syllable, I have to have already had some sense of that when I say the S in the syllable. But I don't really know what I'm going to say. I'm kind of committed. Once I've said so, I'm committed to saying U or W. But now I'm getting a little too picky, I guess. I don't know what I'm going to say. I certainly didn't know 20 seconds ago that I was going to be talking about syllables, or that I was going to be making funny sounds like, oh. Mm-hmm. Of course, some things we do know in advance, because some things we say are part of the temporal order. If somebody asks you, how are you? We can kind of predict in advance that we'll say whatever we usually say, just fine, or doing great, most of the time we'll answer that way. So there's some predictions you can make, but really we don't know the future. We can't predict the future. And the fact that we can predict it in this very rough way, or this way that has to do ultimately with the movement of the sun and the earth through space, but then translates into the calendar and next Sunday we're going to meet again, the fact that we can do that roughly disguises the fact that we don't have a clue what's going to be happening a week from now. We only have, we have clues. That's probably a good way to say it. We have clues. I actually like the fact that the word clue in English, if you look up the original meaning, it meant a ball of yarn. And a clue was something you traced out. You got to the goal by tracing out. That's how the connection got made between a ball of yarn and a clue, in the sense of some vague idea or some hint as to what's happening. We can follow the thread from this Sunday to next Sunday, and we can predict that we will be here this Sunday, next Sunday. But we don't know the details at all. So in one of the books, one of the TSK books, Rinpoche talks about the peas on a plate, and I like that image. He says, for our ordinary purposes, all of the peas on the plate are identical. But of course they're not. Not a single one of them is the same as any other. And, they all have their own history and so on. But if we put them on a spoon and eat them, we don't care. We don't care about the difference between one pea and the other. We just are happy to treat them all as being identical. And when we have a kind of this vague, imprecise notion of what time is, where we think that we're really getting at what time is by saying, well, there's this moment and there's another moment and there's the next moment and so on. The fact that we think that tells us something about time just shows us that we don't care very much. We don't care about time. We care about our lives, and we wish they were more alive. And it turns out that that really depends entirely, almost, in a certain sense, on bringing time alive. But we don't ordinarily make that connection. So we want to make that connection. That's what we're interested in. We're really at the end, and I'm assuming that this is kind of an introductory class, so we haven't done a practice together. I haven't really encouraged you to participate, but of course I do encourage you to participate. Next week we'll do a practice and let that be a more important part of what we do during the phone call. But today it's just been me talking. But I did suggest a homework assignment, which was to share something on the website about a time, about an experience or an occasion when time seemed dramatically more alive. So that's one thing I'm asking you to do. There is also a suggestion that we didn't have time to really talk about today, but we will talk about next time. It's at the very bottom of page 93. He's been talking about the future, and he says, to engage the future directly, which would mean engaging the aliveness of time, that's really what he's been saying, we can practice coming toward the future with a way of knowing suited to its ongoing becoming. So that's the clue about where we're headed. What is a way of knowing? How could we know differently? A way of knowing that was suited to the ongoing becoming, which is another way of saying the ongoing aliveness of the future. That's where we want to go. And then I'm going to give you one more thing to think about or work with. This is an exercise. I'm not going to give you any instructions or anything because we're out of time, but take a look at and maybe start experimenting with exercise 11 in the Dynamics book. It's on page 289. And if my notes are right, but let me double check, it's called Telling Stories. Let me double check that. Yes, Telling Stories. So there are stories that flow through consciousness. Stories are related to the linear structure of time, and we will want to be looking at that. So for next week, the homework assignment, the exercise telling stories, and just reflect on this relationship between our ordinary understanding of time and the possibility of a different way of knowing that could tune us into the becoming of the future. That's where we are. And I will write an orientation, hopefully sometime today, so it'll be posted for next week. And that's where we'll end today. Thanks for your patience. I'm sorry it was just all me, but I hope you have a week full of becoming and aliveness.